Hello and welcome to the Bagel Podcast, Coronavirus Special Report with me, Hayden Cohen. This is a bit of a different episode as we'll be hearing how a cross-section of the community is responding to COVID-19. The aim is, in the midst of madness, to provide some positivity. It is by no means comprehensive, and apologies if I've missed something huge. Take this episode as an overarching snapshot. We have our rabbinic bases covered, with the senior rabbi of Reform Judaism, Laura Janna Klausner, providing an update, as well as Rabbi Eli Pink of Chabad Leeds informing us what they're doing, served with a side order of Hasidish storytelling. We hear how the community is responding with Marshall Fries and Simon Williams of the Leeds Pesach pop-up shop and how they've had to adapt. Laurie Rackhind of Jamie discusses their sprawling mental health provision. All the way from Israel, we have Haggai Rossman of the Weissman Institute talking to us about how big data is shaping the fight against coronavirus. Professional nerd Keith Brooks will be educating us as to why Zoom is better than the rest when it comes to live streaming our Seder. And to provide the haroset, gluing it all together, we have Miriam Laurie, who will share how this period of self-isolation is reminiscent of the first ever Seder night. But first, Orthodox comedian Ashley Blaker shares some of the ways he's helping to keep our spirits up. So I'm joined by Ashley Blaker, the famous Orthodox comedian. It's an honour to have you here. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm not going stir crazy yet. And even in quite a few things for people who are locked away in isolation. Just want to talk us through those things you've done so far.
You know, obviously, I'm certainly no key worker, let's make that clear. But when we are in this kind of situation like this, it's amazing how everyone goes, oh, we need you to keep us entertained. You know, everyone does need a smile on their face. Plus, I've got time on my hands because everything I was doing was cancelled. Luckily, I just finished an off-Broadway run, which was luckily finished just at the right time. Then I had lots of other dates across the United States, but then this all happened. I came back and got the time on my hand a little bit. I put together a book called The Coronavirus Isolation Book. It's about 107, it took me about a week. I had an idea actually on the plane home from New York. So it'd be quite a fun thing to put together. Lots of silly thoughts I've had over the years, stuff I've posted on Facebook, stuff, redesign and rework them for a slightly different format, like size format, I mean. So I wanted to make something that was easily shareable, people could send it around. And so I've no idea, but what the funny thing is, some of the pages inside are clickable. And there's one thing in it that I've asked people to use their time in isolation to settle one of the big debates of Anglo-Jewry, which is which Kiddush wine is the most disgusting, Kedem or Purwin. And there's a vote in it you can actually click, and it takes you through to a page I set up where you can vote. And I keep getting notifications via email that people have voted. So people are definitely looking at it and clicking through and voting. And it's kind of neck and neck, by the way, at the moment. So there's lots of funny stuff there, and it's great. And I really enjoy putting it together. And I put in the introduction, actually, you said, because I've got people who follow me and like me all over the world. And I wrote, I said, look, please note, because some people are going to say, oh, that I don't get that. It's very British. You know, it's an old joke about, there's a joke about Diane Abbott, say, for example. So no one in America knows Diane Abbott. And there's some jokes that are very American. There's some that are a bit more from, there are some that are a bit less from. And I've just said, look, if you don't enjoy one page, you'll enjoy the next. Because it's a rare person that gets every single joke. But there you go, something I wanted to do. Going to be doing an online show like with all new material. But it's, you know, just trying to do what you can.
Ashley Blaker, thank you very much. And from jokes to something that's no joke, food. I talked to the organisers of the Leeds Pesach pop-up shop about how they've adapted and helped with social distancing. So I'm joined by Marshall Fries and Simon Williams of the Leeds Pesach pop-up shop. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Very well indeed.
Good. Really good, thanks, Hayden.
I just want to say before we carry on, just to listeners, usually I would not interview people who own shops. However, I think what you're doing is slightly different. So do you just want to, I don't want to explain that. You explain why I have no issue telling people about what it is that you're doing, and you'll be right.
Just over 2 years ago, unexpectedly, the sole supplier to the Leeds community of Kosher for Pesach food closed its doors. I guess it's fair to say the community was in panic. They're still gourmet foods, which is predominantly a fresh meat butcher. However, the Moretown Deli, which supplied anything and everything, closed its doors. And I guess we were left in a bit of a panic. The whole community was left in a bit of a panic, as I say. Simon and I just were talking and sort of said, well, wouldn't it be a great idea if we could do a pop-up shop? And literally within 4 days, we had location, finance, supply, logistics, procurement, everything in place. And it snowballed, really, and now we're in our third year. This, without doubt, is going to be our most difficult year for obvious reasons. We've got a really strong community in Leeds, a really growing community as well, and I think it's really important that we've got this offering for them, to be fair.
In terms of handling what is the coronavirus, how have you adapted this year to respond to that?
So, obviously, government guidelines have changed on a daily basis over the last week or 10 days. And in the same vein, we have had to adapt exactly what service we offer to everybody. We should have opened yesterday at 10 o'clock in the morning. People would have been in shopping with us yesterday, but we are now closed door. We have issued to all in the community a full list of our products that are available. People have got to fill that list in and send it to us. We've got a full pick, pack and collection operation going here, but also given the isolation factor for so many people who are either self-isolating or have been told to stay at home, we are offering a delivery service as well. So we've really had to change how we go about it. We've had nearly 400 orders so far, which we need to process, but it's only the two of us. The two of us in here on our own, staying within the limits that we've been given, using hand wash and keeping our gloves on and our masks on every day so that both Marshall and I stay fit and healthy and able to deliver this. This is not about ego, but at the moment, we are probably two of the most important people in the Jewish community right now, because what we've got to deliver is something that an awful lot of people really, really need.
Usually with these community projects, there's people who grumble. Have you had that at all?
Not at all. Honestly, whilst obviously there are difficulties for people who may not be as IT literate as others, we've been able to help those people, but nobody is grumbling at all. We've not had any complaints. Some might say that is unprecedented within our community. But no, you know what? Everybody has been nothing but supportive. We've had so many messages of support from people on Facebook, via email, calls, messages, and we're really grateful for it because it's just keeping us going, really.
Great. Before we finish, is there anything that either you'd like to add that we haven't touched on?
I think from my perspective, I just want to say thank you to everybody that's been supportive. And as Simon mentioned earlier, everybody has been supportive. We've had no negativity. We're very passionate about it. And it's so heartwarming when we see people come in and we get the emails through with the orders and we get such positivity. You know, thank you so much for what you're doing. And without you, I don't know how I'd manage, especially the older members of the community. The flip side to that is that there are certain people in the community that still prefer to go to Manchester. And that's something that we can't stop. We have to respect that. But what we would say is give us an opportunity, give us a chance. We're doing this for you. The community is at the heart of what we're doing. And just please continue to support us.
Marshall Fries, Simon Williams, thank you so much for your time and good luck with the pop-up. All that talk of food has made me hungry. Hungry for big data. Seamless segue. So I have the honour of being joined by Haggai Rossman from the Weizmann Institute in Israel, who's been doing lots of work with the response to coronavirus on the scientific side. Welcome, how are you doing?
Hi, very good. Thank you, Hayden. Nice to be here.
It must be a very busy time, I'd expect, at the moment.
Yeah, many sleepless nights, long days, lots of work, but we're trying to combat this.
So do you want to just explain what the project is that you're working on?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So we here at the Weizmann Institute of Science, Eran Segal's group, we deal every day with the challenges and the potential of big data and machine learning in healthcare. So a small team over here, pretty much now all the lab, wonderful people, started a small project that since then grew to nationwide scale, and we'll talk about that soon. A simple survey, 1 minute survey that every citizen in Israel, we want him to fill it out, less than 1 minute, that simply asks you what are your symptoms that are coronavirus-like symptoms like headache, fever, nausea, things like that, a few background, a little bit of background on the person itself. And of course, we know the time and location to the street level, not to the individual flat level, but to the street level. And we ask every citizen to fill this out once a day. We started more than 2 weeks ago, actually, I think 16 days ago, if I'm correct. It's slowly growing. We're now at the speed of more than 100,000 responders a day in Israel, nearly 500,000 different responses since the project started. We're working very closely now with the Ministry of Health, which just now, as we speak, like an hour ago, put this as an official survey of the Ministry of Health of Israel. So that's what we want. We want to capture all this data, and we're already capturing it from 2 weeks ago. Combine this data with other knowledge and other data that we have, and together with many smart people, both here in the group and help from high-tech companies here in Israel and abroad, and other people here that are helping us a lot, Asadna, which is like an open source community that helped us put up this chatbot. We're trying to make sense of all this huge amount of data. It's becoming huge, more than 500,000 people. We want to get to 1 million a day, and we will. And we actually want to make another complementary strategic tool for this decision makers here in Israel. Testing, PCR testing, the correct way to test for COVID-19. It's limited here in Israel. We can do maybe a few thousands a day, maybe 10,000 if we get to the right size. But we need something bigger. We need some kind of map of the situation in Israel, which can track everyone. So what we really want to do is kind of get this symptoms map on a neighborhood scale on all of Israel, all parts of Israel, both in the Orthodox Jews communities and the Arabic community. Every community is over here in Israel. And with this map, we want to use cutting edge tools. Once we have more data and big data, we can do that to try to first detect outbreaks, community outbreaks. At a later stage, we're already looking at that. Try to even predict this from neighborhood symptoms levels.
Will you get that data from, say, the Haredi communities? Like, are they engaging?
Both the Haredi community and also the other minorities communities here, it's harder to engage with them, of course, but we're trying hard, both in the media. Every day we're at the national television. There are people that are talking to community leaders at the municipal level and others. And yeah, we're trying to get to all communities of Israel. It's a tough task.
Because again, like managing to get down to the street level, that's pretty mad. Like when you get your head around that, is there anything comparable in the world that's doing anything similar?
Great question, because we actually were talking with lots of researchers and companies around the world. We are already kind of starting a consortium of researchers, both from UK, USA, China, and many other people. Some of them have already started similar endeavors. I think Team Spectre in the UK, if I'm correct.
And then there's the idea then that all the data from around the world will then feed into one giant database to try and figure stuff out, or is that not on the cards?
Yeah, so I think the first step is first to help at the community level, at the country level, because this is kind of an outbreak which is geographically confined at the beginning. But yes, we do want to pool together data from different countries to learn more about what we can do with this data, both with models that we can share. And of course, we also want that everybody will have shared data. There are some issues with that, of course. Everyone has their own regulations and privacy issues and so on. But I think from what I see in the last 2 weeks, things are moving rapidly fast. I've never seen anything like that in my short time in academia or in other endeavors. And I'm sure the cooperation will continue and be bigger even yet.
Are there any concerns in Israel about privacy? Or is this something that most Israelis are shrugging their shoulders about, going, okay, maybe it's not great, but we need to do it for the greater good?
I think Israel, like other modern societies, yeah, that people here are, they think about their privacy as well. We think about it as well when we engineer these surveys and we think how to distribute them. So we're really trying to look at the neighborhood level. We're not even trying to get any personal identifier, and anything that can identify someone personally, we keep very safe.
How do you define a neighborhood? Like, how big is a neighborhood?
Yeah, good question. It's something that we're also tackling. So we're kind of using known neighborhoods that we get from kind of state censoring data. It's a bit technical, but we have all kinds of different aggregations. So in maybe in the large cities, it could even be like a street level, and maybe in villages or, you know, kind of more spread out communities, it could be something bigger geographically.
So how long do you project it's going to be until you can formulate an overview of how Israel is coping and responding to COVID-19?
We do have sort of a map of every day of what's happening, at least at the neighborhoods, that we have enough people that responded. Of course, this is a big issue. That's why we're engaging so much with the public, because this project is built on the pillars of people filling this out each day. But we do have this map for many neighborhoods already, and we can see changes over time. And hopefully, after we do our work correctly modeling this, we might be able to detect a change which is meaningful. And maybe this can help the policymakers, you know, the Ministry of Health, do more testing in that neighborhood, or maybe help that neighborhood in some other way with other measures that can be done. Something maybe interesting that's also in our paper. We're trying to combine the data that we are gathering with data about the confirmed COVID-19 cases in Israel. There's more than 3,000, 4,000 even, I think, today. We know the places that these people live, and also before the quarantine they were around. And we try to combine that with the symptoms that we have. And we actually do see some small effects here and there. We still need more sample size. We need to gather more data before we can really be certain with this. But we're starting to see a signal, yes.
So two things. One, is there anything else you want people to know about? And two, I'm sure most people who need to know where to go. But if they don't, where do they go to partake in the surveys?
So if you're in Israel, of course, so you can go to coronaisrael.org, coronaisrael.org, and fill the form out. It's both in English, Hebrew, Arabic, Russian. We have many languages. If you're not in Israel, I think you should check. Many countries have already started. And yes, I'd like to say thank you to many wonderful people who are helping us with this project. Aya, Amir, Smadar, Tomer, and the whole group. And yeah, lots of people are making this happen. So thank you.
Hagai Rossman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seriously amazing work. If any time calls for a benevolent big brother, surely it's now. And from science to religion, here's Rabbi Eli Pink of Chabad Lubavitch Leeds discussing what they've been up to. So I'm now joined by Rabbi Eli Pink of Chabad Lubavitch Leeds. Did I get that right?
That's very good.
So do you just want to explain what Chabad has been doing in its response to the COVID-19 crisis?
Okay, so we'll start with look at the negatives, I suppose. First of all, following government guidelines and everything else, Chabad has been very diligent in shutting down our schools, shutting down our shuls, shutting down our men's mikvahs, all those sort of things. You know, you always have some outliers in any society. When you look outside and you have people who are still not social distancing and not partying, so I can't say every single member of Chabad Lubavitch is following those guidelines as diligently as they should, but certainly the message from top down and anyone I've seen in any of our multiple WhatsApp groups and so on, they are keeping to those guidelines. And then on the positive side, we've been reaching out to our community, supporting them as best as we possibly can. I know nationally there's an effort, we're putting together a Seder to Go kit, which will have inside it Shmur Matzah, wine, Haggadah, everything you need for your Seder plate, a how to run your own Seder guide, and a roll-up Seder plate. So that's something that is being coordinated nationally that each branch is going to be able to order and distribute. There's a lot of discussion about, you know, making sure we're following the guidelines. When they're being made commercially. When they're being distributed, that if we're using volunteers to distribute, all the guidance that is out there for deliveries. So Seder to Go kits is one of the big areas that we're concentrating on. And in many ways, it's beautiful that we're all working together on this, because, you know, it is quite usual that each Chabad house will do their thing, but this is something that we're all working together on because everyone sees a need for it. They're going to be made centrally, which makes things a lot easier for those who are in like smaller locations. You know, imagine, you know, some of my colleagues in, I don't know, Bristol or Cardiff or places like that would struggle to put something together. So, you know, this is what we're doing. We're doing both the practical, you know, helping people observe the mitzvahs as much as possible, and the inspirational, the classes and the encouragement. And when this is going on up and down the country, the they're supporting those who are self-isolating, those who are vulnerable with volunteer schemes. We've got one here in Leeds, and other places do as well, that people can sign up online to be a volunteer or to get help if they need help. And we're feeding in with other organisations as well to make sure everyone is being covered.
When you say follow halakha as much as possible, what leniences are there this year that haven't been previously? And is there any way that these leniences will continue into the future? So that's a two-parter.
Okay, so you're talking about in general or for Pesach or...
Either and both.
Okay, so, you know, in halakha we recognise something called bidyavad, which means once you have done it... is it okay or is it not okay? Bidyavad literally means once it has been done. And halacha recognizes this, and it recognizes that sometimes someone is in a bidyavad situation. If we have time, I'll share my favorite story of this crisis before we finish, which also shed some light on it. But let me just say a couple of words about Pesach as well. So the same thing with Pesach. I believe London Beth Din have or are putting out certain guidance, you know, as regards other guidance, cleaning and so on.
I was amazed to see they've allowed bagels for Pesach.
Ooh, careful what you say.
They haven't. It's a joke. If anyone's listening, that is a joke.
Made from potato starch. So there are leniences, you know, I've seen about Pesach cleaning as well. Person doesn't need to drive themselves meshuggah. I mean, one never needs to drive. You know, people do confuse Pesach cleaning with spring cleaning. Then again, as someone told me, if you don't clean, you can always tell a house that's never been cleaned for Pesach because it's never been properly cleaned. But no, you don't need to empty out every book and check if it has chametz in, which, Hayden, you've been to my house, you know what extensive library I have. Normally on Pesach, I would be checking every book for Pesach. This year, I'm not. I'm going to check the ones that you set them aside and cover up the rest. Seven kids at home, it's very difficult to Pesach clean. So yeah, so there are leniences. The best thing is each person should speak to their local, you know, I will say Orthodox rabbi, and speak it through with them. I know we're going to be doing, in Leeds, we're going to be doing Zoom classes about how to prepare for Pesach, how to prepare a Seder, you know, what leniences are all around. But yeah, so maybe we'll finish with my favourite story of this era, which you might have heard already, I've been putting it around. And it's a story of two great Hasidic Rebbes. They were called Reb Zusha and Reb Elimelech, and they were brothers. And these were the third generation of Hasidut. So the Hasidic movement was started by the Baal Shem Tov, and Reb Zusha and Reb Elimelech were followers of the Baal Shem Tov's successor. But they used to travel around incognito, as was common in those days among the Hasidic Rebbes, wanted to mix with the less learned folk and encourage them in their Judaism and encourage them in their service of God. And one time they're traveling around and some of the people who they were hanging around with weren't the best individuals, and they got picked up by the police, and the police accused them of being shoplifters. And so they're sitting in this Russian jail with a bunch of ruffians, and it's, you know, jail, the Russian jail was like one big room where everyone's sitting around, kind of like a holding cell. And it's time to daven mincha. Reb Elimelech gets up to daven mincha, and Reb Zusha points out that in the middle of the room there's a bucket that the prisoners are using for their personal needs. And he says to his brother, you can't daven with that in the room. You can't daven in a toilet. And Reb Elimelech sits down and is a bit deflated. You know, we can't have a mincha, he's upset. Reb Zusha said to him, you know, what are you so upset about? The same God that told us to daven mincha said that in a toilet, you don't daven mincha. In fact, you should be happy because every day you get to do the mitzvah of davening mincha. Now Hashem is giving you a new mitzvah today of not davening. You should rejoice at this new mitzvah opportunity. And Reb Elimelech thought about it for a moment. He said, you're right. And he got up and he started dancing. And Reb Zusha and Elimelech are dancing around the bucket. And the Russian guard hears a commotion. He says, what's going on? You're not supposed to be happy in jail. He comes running over. What are these guys dancing about? These Mishigoi, what are they dancing? And he asked one of the Russian prisoners. He said, no, they're happy about the bucket. They're dancing about the bucket. So the guard says, you're happy about the bucket? I'll teach you. I'll take that bucket away, then see how you manage. So the guard storms in and takes the bucket out. Well, now Reb Zusha and Reb Elimelech can daven mincha. So for me, the lesson is twofold. For me, the lesson is, number one, the same God that brought this corona is going to take this corona away, right? Whether through natural means, through social distancing and vaccination and the tremendous NHS that we have, or through supernatural means. He brought it, he can decide it's time for it to go, because the whole thing makes no logical sense. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the same God who wants us to daven with a minion and wants us to do everything that we normally do, he is the same God who's told us that right now, this isn't what I want you to do. You know, so one doesn't have to be what we call in Yiddish an uber chacham and think, oh, I can break into the mikveh and I can go to mikveh myself, or, you know, I can have a minion in my house with people standing 2 meters apart from each other because I've got a very big dining room. Hashem doesn't want you to do it. That is what the service of Hashem is right now. And the third point is, we have to be happy because this same God that gave us the mitzvah to daven with a minion and daven happily has given us a mitzvah not to. And we have to be happy in that. And hopefully, if we're happy through the mitzvah of serving God with happiness and listening to what he really wants from us, then he'll take this corona away. And hopefully, with the ultimate happiness, with the coming of Mashiach now.
So for anyone who hasn't been exposed to those type of stories before, I grew up with them from Rabbi Reuven Cohen, also at Leeds Chabad, and I got this great big hit of nostalgia from Lubavitch day camps when I was 5, hearing lots of similar stories. And I just want to say thank you so, so much for a beautiful, beautiful story that for once I think I can appreciate without even the slightest hint of cynicism. And now, with less Messiah but no less spirit, here's Rabbi Laura Jana Klausner. So I'm now joined by Senior Rabbi Laura Jana Klausner from Reformed Judaism. How are you doing?
I'm fine, and every time I'm fine, I'm incredibly thankful. So whereas in the past you'd say I'm fine, now I'm like, I'm fine, thank God. And I'm just so grateful that I'm okay.
Yeah, but I know that COVID-19 has already affected the Reform community. I saw the sad news about Rabbi Neil Kraft, who was a few days short of retirement, wasn't he?
Yes, we were yesterday meant to have his retirement tea. How sad is that?
But with a, there's no, I'm not minimising
it. You're not belittling anything, of course.
No, I'm saying that that what I'm trying to do in this episode is both acknowledge that there's something going on, but trying to focus on how the community is positively responding to it, because it's very easy to see the bad bits, but not so easy to see the good ones. So I wondered if you could just share what Reformed Judaism has been doing at the moment.
So there's two different things, well, I suppose three different things. First of all, from the point of view of the central organisation, Reformed Judaism, we've been providing a lot of emotional support. We provided massive amounts of resources, online siddur, online funerals, online shiva books and Haggadah. We are doing online services every single evening and morning. We're having Shacharit and Ma'ariv so that people can be together and also people can say Kaddish. And this is not for Reform communities at all. Lots of people want to say Kaddish who haven't been able to go to Shivas. And we invite everyone who needs a minyan to come together with us. So part of it is delivering online content. We have RJTV, which is content all the way through. So teaching, learning, content all the way through the day. And also our job is to amplify and strengthen our communities. Our communities, I have to say, our clergy are amazing. They are doing a sterling job, not only of using technology, which some of them haven't used properly before and really are enjoying the empowerment of it. They are leading services on Shabbatot online and also in the week and teaching and also putting out a lot of content. And they're doing a lot of funerals. So not only are they working unbelievably hard and stressfully, you know, so much stress in the week, they're also working throughout Shabbatot in very much in public and also in a way that is actually more tiring. It's funny to say that when you have people with you, you're leading a service, you get the feedback from their bodies, their smiles, their hugs, their affirmation. You are on your own, either at home or on your own in the Beit Tefillah, in the synagogue itself, and you're talking to a machine. I did a online bat mitzvah. Wow, it's, I can't even count. 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, just before we started total isolation, and we were all separated out. So I wasn't near them, but I could see them. But it was very, very hard. So we have reinvented Judaism. And for instance, at Pesach, there are a lot of online starim happening. And I am broadcasting Second Night Seder from my home, not only to lots of Jews and friends of Jews, to reform communities, but also to Jewish care. So their care homes will also have our Seder streamed, my Seder streamed from home. And my lovely family who are with me, my partner David and daughter Ella, I try not to conscript them in as rabbis' families because it's quite hard, but they are going to do it with me as well. Bless them, because it's pretty hard to be kind of on show as well. I'm paid for this, they're not. So bless them.
I mean, it sounds a bit like the American chat show hosts, where they're still trying to have the same rhythms that they would have in front of an audience, and you can see these pauses when they're trying to wait for applause. So I suppose I get that completely.
It's good. I just want to say two things. One is, I love what you just said about rhythms. It is about keeping the same Jewish rhythm. However, we can, depending on what's happening with Zoom, you can unmute people so you can hear each other singing. What I didn't say, the other thing that we're doing, is that RSY, Reform Synagogue Youth, have rebranded to Remote Synagogue Youth, and they are putting out content all day as well. And they have now, all weekend, it's going on upstairs as well, because my daughter's a movement worker, Veda, the AGM that they have every year, 44 of them online. And occasionally I'm sitting in the next door room and I hear, ya la 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 la, ya la 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 la, ooh, coming in from the other room. And you can hear all these different voices, absolutely brilliant. It's fantastic. So you can hear more than not the clapping of a chat show.
I mean, yeah, that's one thing you don't have when you're conducting a service in a shul. You can't just mute the congregation, can you?
No, I was about to say it's a fantasy, but it's not. It's the opposite. It would be a nightmare to mute the congregation. We've spent years and years in Reform Judaism focusing on participation. So God forbid we should be muting people.
And just one final question, unless there's something else that you want to add. How do you think what we're going through now is going to impact on Judaism going forward?
Oh, that's a great question. And in fact, I'm just about to start a PhD to look at that.
So it's a short answer then, I'm sure.
Oh, what's your short
answer? No, I'm joking.
Not a PhD answer. I'm joking. How will it... I think people are chalishing, are desiring community and understanding the need for community in a way that they might have taken before. So I think people will come more into synagogues. I think from the point of view of Reform Judaism, we are going to have loads of more people involved because they've seen what we do. And that's great.
Rabbi Laura Jana Klausner, thank you very much for your time. And it's not only the Reform movement that's holding online Sedarim. There were some senior Israeli rabbis, and I mean senior rabbis, who came out and said that Zoom, the video conferencing app, could be used to conduct remote Seder nights, and they were specific about Zoom. It's since been rescinded, definitely not because of communal politics, nudge nudge wink wink say no more, but here to talk through why Zoom was even mentioned in the first place is from Jew and professional nerd Keith Brooks, who's worked for IBM and Lotus Notes amongst others. This interview starts a little bit in due to some technical issues, which is ironic really.
I had seen the responsa from some rabbis somewhere that basically said that they were going to allow someone to use Zoom for their Seder, for their parents, to talk to their parents, do whatever. And that, of course, sparked a major controversy for many people. And one of the things that was interesting to me in reading it was, first of all, what they were actually referring to, which is not what people thought, and second of all, why they chose Zoom over anything else. And so I then proceeded to write a Facebook post that I posted also on Twitter and other places, outlining a basic idea why Zoom was chosen over other applications. Presumably that's where you wanted to ask about.
Yeah.
So basically what I was trying to do was basically explain why Zoom. And so I tried to keep it as simple as possible without going into heavy halachic issues. I was really just looking at the technical issue. And the one that I was trying to get across to people was basically Zoom, unlike, for example, Skype, Zoom is a fully duplexed piece of software. What that means in layman's terms is it's like you've opened up one side and you've opened up the other side, and both sides can talk, do whatever they want for both ends. Nothing is waiting to bounce off each other. Nothing is waiting like a walkie-talkie, I say, then you say kind of thing. And so compared to a number of different apps, Facebook Messenger also is only partially duplexed. Skype is only partially duplexed. And so I was basically trying to write some explanation for people purely from the perspective of someone will just take this and go, oh, we can use Skype, then we can do this. And the answer really is no, because the rabbis chose to actually say Zoom, not other things. And I believe this was one of the reasons.
So I'm still not quite sure. When you say effectively, if you are stepping in front of a camera, then you are affecting what goes into it, aren't you?
Right, right.
You're affecting the light.
There's way too many other issues relating to it. But the simple aspect is, one, the difference of whether you're causing something to happen or whether something is already there no matter what goes on around it. So it's kind of like if you have a faucet running, the water only runs down. The water does not run up into the faucet back out to the main, naturally. And that's kind of the difference between a fully duplex solution and a partial or half duplex.
Is it like having if you have like an outside light, like a security light, if you switch that on and you keep it on for overnight, then that would effectively be a duplex approach, whereas if it's got a proximity sensor, then it wouldn't be.
So the proximity sensor would be the half duplex, because it only is kicking in when something goes in front of it or near it. Part of the idea was this. Obviously, the belief, of course, is it said, no, you can't really use Zoom for this purpose, naturally, from a Orthodox religious perspective. The way they had written it was that it was really for people, almost like a pikuach nefesh, saving a life for people who have no way to be with anybody. And it can be very hard, especially for older people who are basically locked up at home and have no way to talk to anybody and do anything. And that was the original response, which has, of course, has been retracted, and a whole bunch of people, of course, argued against it. But whether someone will or won't, the idea was basically, I was trying to explain that it's if you already have something that's on, because you have your computer and you turn it on, you load up Zoom, then the people on the other end will do that same thing, and that's up there. Whether you have that sitting on your table, on your desk, on your wall, whatever you want to call it, it's just there and it's running all the time. Whatever you say and do is transmitting. There's no question of that. And that's a whole other discussion about what that actually means halachically. But the premise of not opening the call and not starting the call and not doing anything for the call is resolved by having this fully duplex system, because it doesn't matter. You and I can talk, we can see each other, do whatever, but we're not causing anything to actually happen per se in the sending part.
Oh, is this because on Zoom you have your own Zoom link that people can tune into, as opposed to on Facebook or Skype or whatever, where you have to pick the contact? Is that the point?
Not so much that way, because obviously I would, let's say, use this to talk to my grandmother, for instance, or like you and I are talking now. So it would already be open and running. But the idea would be, if you were using Skype, for instance, it's almost like the walkie-talkie. It's like I say something and then you receive it and then you can reply. But on Zoom, as I'm talking, you can be talking at the same time, and we hear and see everything going at the same time all the time.
Got it. Okay. Oh, that's really interesting.
I think what I read from somebody was it's a rabbinic aspect of what you would be breaking.
Right.
Because there's actually a whole argument in Judaism about what electricity is. There's a couple different theories about what actually is electricity, as far as what are you breaking the law by using electricity for. And that in itself then creates a different discussion among the people who are arguing the points as to, well, if it's electricity, then you can't do this. But if it's not electricity, it's just building something, but we're not building anything because it's actually already open and already available, then is it still a problem? And that's where you get into some very deep halachic / technical discussions.
I mean, I think the fact that the discussion's even happening is...
It's cool.
It's really cool. It's a big step.
At least to me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a slow view of how you let the world around you into the world that you want to be part of, but you're just that one piece short of how or why. And the change in as we've seen here in many places, nobody can really get together anymore to go pray at shul anymore. So if you can't get to a minyan, how do people say Kaddish? How do people hear Torah reading? There's a whole bunch of things that the Rabbanim around the world right now are dealing with, all types of questions and answers, some of which are going to be good and some of which probably won't be so great by people. And obviously to each country and in each region and city, sometimes you're going to have difference of opinions.
Keith Brooks, thank you very much for your time. And from Zoom to zooming all around the place, another stellar transition, if I do say so myself. Here is Laurie Rackhind of Jamie Again, a few technical issues resulting in me sounding like a robot who'd eaten too much matzah, but I started by asking what Jamie means.
Jamie stands for Jamie now. It used to be, and I suppose it still officially is, Jewish Association for Mental Illness. But we just go by the name of Jamie. One of the reasons being, to be honest, there is still a stigma around mental illness. And so it's not always helpful to use the term mental illness, although thankfully that stigma is reducing. And if there is any heartening thing coming out of the current crisis, it's the fact that we are at least acknowledging that mental health is the parallel conversation with the COVID-19 direct virus health issues. We do know and we understand that trauma is definitely a contributory factor to poor mental health. And, you know, the very concepts of social distancing, and I don't like to use the term social distancing, we use the term physical distancing and physical isolation rather than social distancing and social isolation. But that very concept of isolation and social distancing for people that already, unfortunately, because of their health, are isolated and are distanced from the community, it's not a helpful concept. It might be a great concept in terms of public health terms for the direct implications of a virus, but in terms of the public health well-being of the nation, it's not a great concept. Maybe through this, we'll start to understand some of those experiences of people that aren't as healthy as we have been. And interestingly also, some of those people that have developed resilience and techniques and management techniques for their mental health conditions and their mental health over time, we need to possibly, those people that haven't had to learn those techniques will now have to learn them. At any one time, we're managing a caseload of about 1,300 people. What we had to do immediately, given the current situation, is effectively do a risk assessment across that whole group to work out the people that were most at risk. For instance, of those 1,300 people, there were 300 or 400 people that were regularly attending one of our hubs. Thankfully, not everybody needs a building-based service anymore, but a lot of people were attending those hubs. And for those most vulnerable, that was potentially their only hot meal of the day when they were coming to one of our hubs. So we basically had to go through and identify those people that were most at risk in terms of mental health. We'd already identified who were most at risk in terms of the COVID virus, and we'd had to say that they couldn't come to any of our hubs anyway. So there was an interim period where our hubs were open for everyone that wasn't in the high-risk physical bracket. But what we did is those people that weren't able to come, we were already making telephone contact with them, making sure they had meal deliveries, doorstep chats. And that has been extended. So at the moment, we're up to close on 400 people. I think that we're in a regular phone contact with. We're doing, as I said, we're delivering meals, doorstep chats across London. And as of this week, we've actually got some virtual group support going on. The sorts of activities that took place in our cafe and in our hubs, but we've taken those online. But we had the additional challenge that for a lot of the people using our services, particularly the most vulnerable people, they didn't have access to laptops and tablets and what have you. So we had to procure those really, really quickly. And of course, if you don't have those devices, you don't even have Wi-Fi. So one of the things we've been delivering, as well as doorstep chats and meals, is devices. We've got SIM cards in tablets that we're distributing to people. We have one of our staff who sits there to provide online support and could hook into all their tablets to make sure he can help them through the process of connecting with one of our groups. But when you actually start thinking about it, the exercise of bringing people online, particularly from the sort of demographic that we've been working with, is hugely challenging. I was on a Zoom call this morning with a lot of charities who clearly having to respond to the crisis. I think there's a bit of a distinction between those charities who are really worried about their income and they're having to hunker down and say, look, we've got to look after what we're spending. And charities such as Jamie, who we can't hunker down. We've got more of a demand on our services. It's costing us more. So we've got the double challenge of how are we going to resource all these additional costs, and our regular income is likely to come down. And it really, really is a challenge. But we can't back away and we can't shy away from the needs of those people using our services. And unfortunately, as you would expect, those people that were already using our services need our services more. We were already getting inquiries through from people that had used our services before, but thankfully haven't used them for some time, but they are needing them again. And we're also getting calls from people in the community who have never used our services before, and this is the first time they feel the need to reach out to us. Hopefully will be a huge benefit to all of this. Yes, it's a bit of a reboot for society, but arguably society needed a reboot.
Thanks, Laurie. I took away an incredibly positive message from that. Now to round us out is all-round great person, Miriam Laurie. So joining me now is friend of the show and friend of me, Jewish educator Miriam Laurie. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, Hayden. How are you?
Yeah, good. We're all getting used to the new normal, aren't we?
I don't know if I'll ever totally get used to it, but yeah, definitely adjusting.
I think you had some insight into bringing all of this back round into Seder. You've got that coming up. So just wanted to hear your thoughts, really.
Yeah, well, it really struck me that the first ever Seder was held in isolation. And if you look, you've got to look quite closely at the verses in the Torah to see this. But just to give the context, this was the last night before the Jewish people left Egypt. And it was the night when the 10th plague and the most horrific of all the plagues, the death of the firstborn, happened. And in order for the Jewish people to avoid that plague, Moses gave the following instruction: none of you shall go outside the door of his house until morning. So that word instructs people to stay inside their house, shut the door, and in fact put some kind of plague marking on the outside of their door to keep this destructive force away, keep the plague outside. And in a way, that's sort of what we're doing today. We're shutting our doors in order to keep the plague outside. And so while nobody wants to sugarcoat this Pesach, it's not great, no one wants it, it did strike me that actually, perhaps thinking back to the first Pesach and identifying in some way with what those Jews were going through in isolation and trepidation the night before they left Egypt is in some way an appropriate way to spend this Pesach, this very unusual Pesach.
Miriam Laurie, thank you very much. So after Miriam and I finished recording, we had an awkward moment trying to figure out the correct sign-off. Happy Pesach sounded a bit too upbeat at the moment, and I always find Kashala Pesach offensive, which I talked about on the Pesach special last year, so I won't repeat that one. It was only when I put the phone down that I had my epiphany. I'd like to wish you all a speedy Pesach, and may this virus Pesach us all very soon. Translate it in your head, it makes sense, I promise. Stay safe, bagelers.